Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're tuned in to Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Nathan Fervoy. This week, we're going to start things off with some performing arts from around Minnesota and abroad. It's a broad topic, so reporter AQ stepped out on the street to narrow it down a bit and ask, what are the performing arts?
Performance arts is a unique type of art. It doesn't have a concrete definition because it means differently to everyone. For the question of the week, I asked people what they think performance arts is.
Performance arts to me, well, that would be any sort of art that is meant to entertain the population.
I guess when I think of performing arts, I mostly think of on the stage within a theater, but I guess it's really broader than that. To me, I've mostly thought of it as entertainment, but as a grad student here, some of the productions I've seen have been important social commentary pieces, and that's been, I think, really interesting to me.
I think performing arts is a way for you to get out of your own space. It's like storytelling, where you can experience different perspectives.
It's a source of relaxation and enjoyment, and that's it.
To me, it's probably theater, acting, dance, combination of all those things, I would say.
Performing arts would entail it's a kind of art wherein someone would perform, maybe theater, maybe music, maybe drawing. I think it entails like physical action, like physical performance.
I think performing arts encompasses music and dance, and it's expanding. You know, I mean, you see people doing all sorts of funky things, and I think it could be included in performing arts.
Performing arts would be like artists, like singing and creating things. That's what I would think it'd be. That would be my interpretation.
Those are some great answers. Performance arts is what you make of it. For Real College Podcast, I'm AQ.
From the response to the question, it's clear that there's a lot that can fit under the definition of performing arts. No matter how thorough your list, there's always something new out there to discover in some corner of the planet. On a recent visit abroad, music reporter Lizzie Ritchie stumbled upon one such corner in southern Mexico, discovering a style of music rich in history.
This past May, I was lucky enough to get to travel to Cuernavaca, Morelos, in Mexico with some other University of Minnesota students for a Spanish immersion class. With the majority of us being super interested in music and concerts, our tour guide said he found something we might be interested in going to. There was a free concert happening at the new and recently built Teopan Zocalo Cultural Center. He said he wasn't sure what kind of music it would be, but it would be a fun and interesting opportunity to learn some more about the music and culture of Mexico. To everyone's surprise, we ended up seeing a Spanish Baroque opera. This was a traveling show of just these two men all over Mexico. What is so impressive about this tour, aside from their musical talents, was the instrument that was being played. The instrument you hear is called a harpsichord. It's similar to a clavichord in terms of sound and origin, but it's like an organ in the sense that it has two sets of keys rather than just one. It's such a delicate and old instrument that it is extremely sensitive to environmental changes. It has to be carefully stored in a controlled climate, and even during the show alone, it had to be tuned 7 times, almost once between every song.
Mm-hmm.
harpsichord player was extremely knowledgeable about his instrument and also context about the music. In between songs, he would explain the history of each song, the person who wrote it, and its historical significance. The concert altogether was a collection of the most commonly played pieces for this instrument during the Baroque period. The two musicians were there to not only perform, but to teach the crowd about a specific moment in history for this instrument and the height of its popularity. Luckily, we had our tour guide with us to translate what the two musicians were saying in real time. The woman who composed a majority of the songs played that night was famous for her impressive skills with the harpsichord during the Baroque period. Thousands of people gathered to watch her play.
When it was written, it was by somebody who would be the equivalent of Madonna in his time. She was an organist in Rome. People would arrive by the thousands to listen to her. Imagine that thousands in the 1600s would be hundreds of thousands today. That was her fame, Cristobal.
This opera was something we definitely were not expecting, and was a bit of a different pace than theaters here in Minneapolis. That alone was enough to show us how interesting and rich history can be. Like an entire hour-long show that is also touring just to teach others about a niche part of history and the impact of one composer in the 1600s.
Back on the local scene and appropriately pride-themed, there's another type of performance that goes down most nights in downtown Minneapolis at the famous Gay 90s nightclub. The club hosts music and dance primarily for the local LGBTQ community and welcomes all who walk through its doors. However, its well-known status and prime location downtown has made it a destination for many outside the LGBTQ community. Reporter Charter Jacobson spoke to one former performer at the 90s about their experience there and why they chose to leave.
If you grew up near the Twin Cities like I did, chances are you've at least heard of the Gay 90s. In case you haven't, it's a bar in central Minneapolis that claims to cater to gay nightlife. However, there are many LGBT patrons who feel like this description does not match up with their own experiences at the 90s. There have been stories written about this phenomenon before I was even born, notably NPR's article in 1997 where Chris Roberts interviewed a few people in order to explain why this gradual change was taking place. I was able to interview somebody I know who used to dance at the Gay 90s. I wanted to understand what that space is like for a queer person, and what it felt like for them to perform for a mostly straight audience.
My name is Valcurious. I'm 27, and I dance at the 90s, mostly in 2018, a little bit in 2017. I've been there both as, like, performing, but I also did go there as just a regular person. And I am not super fond of the 90s. A lot of my friends had a lot worse experiences than I did, but I definitely didn't feel comfortable there. I didn't feel terribly safe, and the other patrons, especially later in the night, were not people that made me feel safe at all. And I didn't necessarily feel like the people that worked there would have my back. Another thing that is kind of stressful about the 90s is the gendered bathrooms, and I always go to the gender I was assigned at birth because it's easier and because I often was dressed femme, especially if I was performing, because you get more money. You know, that's just how it works. And I know a lot of people who've been harassed in that sense. It's just disappointing because that place is kind of a historical institution, and it could be better.
I then asked if they think the Gay 90s is a safe space for queer people.
I do not. I feel like the gay 90s is more for people who are wanting to see gays in the wild. They're mostly straight people, especially towards the end of the night, that go there to kind of ogle at drag queens and gay people and try to pick up queer women because they think they can. I would tell people who aren't a part of the queer community to be respectful. The problem with it a lot is that they're just really drunk at that point, and they ask a lot of questions. I've had a lot of my friends being asked, like, are you a boy or a girl? Or what's in your pants, basically. And in this age, and to go into a supposedly queer space and be that uninformed and that rude is not okay. And if you're going to be a part of spaces that you're not within the community, you need to be educated enough to know who you're interacting with. You wouldn't ask people who are straight or who are cis the same questions. So if you don't want to be asked, like, what's in your pants, like, don't do that to other people.
After the questions I had planned to ask, I let Valkyries talk more about their experiences and the reasons why their event ended up leaving.
I mean, I will say that the space itself is really nice, as in, like, the building. I really enjoy the spaces. I enjoy the different, like, locations. And I think that it could be better, and I would really, it would be really nice to feel like I can go there. Fortunately, the people that I was working with that were throwing the event are super great and definitely had your back, but I didn't necessarily feel like the people that work there did too. And I don't necessarily think that's a, like, comment on those people as people. It's just kind of the nature of the atmosphere of the place. The event that I used to be a part of, we ended up leaving that space because so many people felt uncomfortable in that space. A lot of the people who were going there and the people who were working there felt really uncomfortable, and we ended up, quite frankly, we were losing money. It wasn't financially viable because people didn't feel safe going there, both as customers and as performers. When you end up losing money because the people who that space is supposed to be for don't feel comfortable being there, and the majority of your money is probably at this point from straight people, is that space a queer space anymore? I don't necessarily even consider the gay 90s a queer space anymore because it doesn't have the community values of a queer space, in my opinion. As you've seen with many other queer spaces, be them bars or coffee shops or anything, they a lot of times go out of business because they are queer. And the sad truth of that isn't because our community doesn't want to support those spaces. It's because our community tends to be poorer, especially, you know, queer people of color and trans folks. Like, they don't make as much money, so they can't afford to spend money in their own community spaces, and that's why we keep losing them. The Gay 90s doesn't really cater to queer people, and I think that's smart in terms of from a capitalist perspective, but not from a community perspective.
The intersection of wanting to provide a space for queer people to feel safe and needing financial viability could be a major reason why the Gay 90s does not seem to meet the fairly basic expectation of the community. It's not just one person's experience either. Similar accounts have been reported on numerous times. The Gay 90s is one of the only bars around the Twin Cities that actually hosts events for the queer community, such as burlesque and drag, and as a result, many queer people go there out of necessity to participate in the type of nightlife that has been enjoyed by their community for decades. I don't doubt that the people both working at the 90s and putting on these events truly care about what they're doing, but people who are not queer attending these events has an effect of diluting the sense of community and understanding. I want to say thanks to Valkyries for lending me their voice for this interview. I think it's important for people to hear the experiences of those who may come from different backgrounds than them.
Another local institution in Minneapolis is Al's Breakfast in Dinkytown. Though perhaps breakfast isn't typically considered a performing art, Al's, it turns out, has a long-time reputation for supporting local artists as they first get their footing. Ben Hallam has more.
Sure. My name's Doug Grinna. I've owned Al's Breakfast for 40 years and worked here for 42. Before that, I spent 7 years in an experimental theater company. It would probably be called Performance Art now, called the Palace Theater and the Minnesota Ensemble Theater. And when I came over here, a bunch of actors that I knew came and worked for a while. And we've had actors and musicians and photographers and painters. We've had a lot of artists over the years. Steve Sorman worked here. I don't know if your viewers will know who he is. Listeners. Can't see anything on the radio.
That's Doug Grinna, one of the co-owners of Al's Breakfast in Dinkytown, near the University of Minnesota. Al's is perhaps most famous for its status as a neighborhood institution that's been around for nearly 70 years. As part of this reputation, it was even visited by Guy Fieri of Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, who called it, quote, a
funky little place in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
But for this Real College podcast piece on Al's Breakfast, I wanted to look at something different. I wanted to look at the way that Al's Breakfast has been home to a community of artists and creators, including owners Doug Grinna and Allison Kerwin.
I was a dance major at the University of Minnesota.
That's
Allison Kerwin, co-owner of Al's Breakfast.
Who talked to me about how the consistent but flexible scheduling at Al's Breakfast is one of the primary things that allows people to engage in other projects outside of working at the restaurant, including work as artists.
A lot of people at Al's have other things that they do, and I was in school when I started here, and then I worked with a local dance company for a lot of years. And one of the things about Al's is that it's very flexible, and it doesn't often kind of overlap with a lot of other jobs because it's early in the morning to afternoon, and a lot of the other jobs that I've had have been evening sort of situations, especially in restaurants and dancing and stuff. And so this was always kind of a good fit to supplement my income when I was both in school and later when I was dancing and doing other things. So it was an obvious choice to kind of supplement my income as I was moving through college and stuff.
And Allison believes Al's Breakfast has been an obvious choice for a lot of other people as well.
Yeah, I think we've always kind of been that for people. We've always been something that people can schedule around and that there's enough flexibility within the restaurant with other people wanting to work here and pick up shifts, and it's easy to kind of get things covered and do the things that we've always kind of strived to do. We've always had a lot of artists who've worked here, and that seems to be a good fit for a lot of people who have flexible jobs otherwise, too.
According to longtime owner Doug Grinna, this flexibility is no accident. It was part of the reason he came to Al's in the first place, and it's been part of his philosophy ever since.
Yeah, I don't know. Al's has always been an art-friendly place, partially because our schedules are completely flexible, so artists can move around and do the things they need for their own work and still work at Al's. Well, it's always been my philosophy that whenever anybody that I'm working with or that's working for me, I want them to enjoy it so much they want to keep doing it. And they may regret that later. You want to make sure that everybody, your customers, the people you work with, everybody's got to be having a reason to be back.
Some of this dedication to flexibility comes from Grinna's own work as an artist, his background in experimental theater.
Yes, very much. I worked in an ensemble theater company, and we learned to be very much aware of what everybody was doing. And there was a system here always of you can learn the different jobs, but we really emphasize that now, and everybody knows every job. They come in the morning, they decide what they want to do between the dishes, the counter, and the cooking. And that's something I want. I want an ensemble where they all know what each other are doing and they can switch off whenever they can.
This sort of ensemble idea at Al's has played into the way that employees are able to switch off and on, not just between their jobs at the restaurant, but between their pursuits outside of Al's and the community they'd formed within it. Allison Kerwin described the way some of her work at Ragmala Dance Company and the community at Al's has come together over time.
And so working here was a good way to encourage new viewers for the dance company, for one thing. We've also gotten to use this space for fundraisers and things like that. We've done some dinners and things where the company comes in and cooks the food and serves people and stuff. So that's been an interesting way to get our customers involved in what the dance company does and vice versa. I don't know that I've done too much actual dancing behind the counter. It doesn't seem safe. So, you know, that we try to avoid. But Al's attracts a lot of very interesting customers, which a lot of times that kind of, it can be a good sounding board for artists to talk about what they're doing with other people who come in. It's also a good way to make contacts in other sorts of communities, other artist communities. And I think that we give people a lot of freedom here to kind of just be whoever they're going to be, and we don't really try to have just one fit for who our staff is, and I think that is really good for artists and other people who are trying to figure out what they really need to do in life.
As is the case with almost anything, once you get behind Al's Breakfast, the institution, Al's Breakfast, the famous restaurant that someone like Guy Fieri might see, once you really
take a look
at the people who run the restaurant and the people who work there, you'll see that far from being
dumpy
or a dive, it's actually a community of creative, hard-working people, both at the restaurant and outside. At the same time, it is still a restaurant. When I asked owner Doug Grinna if he had any important memories that stuck out to him from his career at Al's Breakfast, he told me this.
Has there been anything, like, interesting experiences that have stuck out to you, interesting people who have come through, any sort of, like, anecdote that you think would be something interesting to share?
You know, every day I come here, I look forward to it. And there have been a lot of interesting people. I mean, it shows more of how your brain works, what you manage to remember. One of the only things I can remember is a bizarre incident with a guy who threw up into a coffee cup. So my memory of what sticks out over the years may be only the Utra.
The Real College Podcast, I'm Ben Hallam.
Of all the culture and performance Minnesota has a reputation for, it is not typically seen as a hub for reality TV. The formidable winter weather here for 8 months out of the year makes it a less than ideal location for tropical themed shows like Survivor. Yet for one mega fan, the denials on his applications to be a contestant on the show couldn't stop him from bringing Survivor unofficially to Rochester, Minnesota. Reporter Tosin Fasimo has more.
Strangers, 2 tribes, $1 million. The stakes are high on Survivor, a U.S. reality TV show about a group of strangers who are brought to a remote island to compete for a cash prize. The show has seen many changes over the years, but there is one constant, the fans. This week, I sat down with Brett Herbers, a self-proclaimed Survivor superfan, to discuss his love for the show in detail.
Hi, my name is Brett Herbers. I'm an incoming senior at the University of Minnesota studying political science and social studies education. So I am a super fan of the show. I've applied to be on the show 5 times. It's a little nerdy, so we're really just putting it out there, huh? Because I'm such a fan of the show and because, you know, I've been inspired by different people who have made their own versions of the show. So it started with Survivor Maryland was what got the idea for me. It's a college-hosted Survivor game put on by a guy named Austin Trupp at the University of Maryland. He started it out there. And so he kind of gave me the inspiration for making my own as well. And so I kind of messaged with him. And, you know, as time passed, all of a sudden my game kind of formed. And so I've put on several different versions of the TV show Survivor locally in Minnesota. So making my own challenges, recruiting my friends and classmates and roommates to play, and just having a good experience with it all.
What specifically do you like about Survivor? Like, what draws you to it so much? What's the appeal there for you?
So I think the appeal of Survivor is the idea that it's kind of the social politics of it all. I think I'm a big people person. That's where my strengths lie. So for me, it's fascinating to see how different people interact with each other, how they use social capital to influence and manipulate and compete in this reality TV show. And so getting to watch kind of the social politics play out is super, super fun for me.
What would you say has been one of the best moments from one of the Survivor games that you have hosted?
So I'll have to throw my friend Nicole under the bus here, but I think Survivor Rochester, what I did, I hosted a game in Rochester in 2018 over the summer, and we had my friend Nicole had a hidden immunity idol, and basically there were 3 people on one team, 3 people on the other, and this guy, Jason Coyle, was in the middle, and he decided to flip on Nicole's team at the last second, and so Nicole had this idol to save herself. Jason flipped, so it was 4 votes Nicole, 3 votes the other person, and Nicole was blindsided, voted out of the game, had no idea it was coming. Jason, one of the wildest moves to ever happen in Survivor Minnesota history. But it was, there are lots of just fun moments throughout it all where the social dynamics change on a dime like that, and so you can never really expect or know for sure what's going to happen because things can change so quickly.
What do you hope other people gain from playing Survivor?
I'd say for me, you know, Survivor for me is something that I've enjoyed for many, many years. It's something that I find a lot of joy in. I think the competitions are fun. I think the social dynamics are fun. And following contestants that have been on the show in real life, after the show, they form all these great bonds and relationships with each other, even though they're backstabbing each other, voting each other out. And I think in every game that I've put on, I've seen people who didn't know each other kind of come together and build new relationships and new bonds over the fact that they played this game and that they spent this time together. And so I guess for me, it's twofold. One, to have fun, right, to put on something fun for my friends and my classmates and students at large in Minnesota, but also to kind of build community in a setting where, you know, because Survivor is not something that you just happen across. It's something, this experience is something very unique. It's very unique to itself in a way. And so for these people playing this unique experience, I think brings them together and kind of forms bonds that wouldn't have been there otherwise.
You mentioned earlier that you have auditioned for Survivor 5 times. So talk about that process. Like, what exactly do you have to do to audition? And, like, why haven't you been picked? You love the show so much.
So you can audition in 2 different ways. You can send in a audition tape to like the CBS website. So you do like a 3-minute clip talking about yourself, telling them why you'd be good on the show. Or you can go to an open casting call. And that's like CBS affiliates will host those locally. And so I've done both. I've sent in videos before and I've gone to an open casting call. But yeah, so those are kind of the options with the process there. But
have you run into any, like, difficulties with the audition process, like, in regard, like, going there? Did you have to drive, like, really far? Or?
So I think one difficulty I've come across is the fact that the Survivor, you know, Survivor wants you to be your authentic self on the videotape, and so one thing for me has been challenging is to make sure I'm portraying my authentic self on my audition tapes and not just making kind of a character of myself. They're looking for real people with real experiences and from real walks of life, right? And so for me, it's important to, you know, not fake who I am and not make it, you know, because I think you can think, oh, they'd like to see this, but really they just want to see who you are. So just kind of keeping that in mind as I'm making my videos, I guess.
Is there anything that you want to add? Any lasting comments?
Survivor, it's a wonderful show. You should watch it. I, you know, being on Survivor is a dream of mine. So if any CBS casting affiliates are listening, you know that I'm your guy. But yeah, no, I think regardless of what happens with this whole process, Survivor is something I think that brings people together in the community, brings people together, you know, that I brought together, that other people have brought together. And I think, you know, it's a fun way for me to kind of pursue a passion while pursuing the ultimate dream of getting on the show someday. So
after talking to Brett, I wondered, could Survivor really bring people together despite the competitive nature of the game? I decided to find out more about his show by interviewing a contestant from one of the previous seasons.
Hey, I'm Egan Choi. I was a contestant on Survivor last summer. I'm currently a college student at Carleton College.
Why did you choose to sign up to play Survivor Rochester? Like, are you really interested in the show, or what was it?
I knew Brett Herbers.
That was it?
Yeah. And I thought he was cool.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
That's fair. When you played the game, were you looking for any specific sort of experience or, like, outcome, or did you just go in blind with no expectations?
I really didn't have any expectations. I just kind of went in there without really anything, like, that I wanted. I just wanted to have fun or maybe have a good experience out of it.
Did you end up having a good experience? I mean, I don't remember how long you were in the game, but was it fun?
Well, to be fair, I did get voted out like first, so I can't really say much about the game itself, but I did have a good time while I was there. Kind of sucks that I got out so fast, but at the same time, short time, good time.
Why did you get voted out first?
Generally, the people on my team were all, like, people who knew each other more intimately or, like, closely compared to, like, the people I knew who were on the other team. Like, everyone I knew personally was on another team. Well, my team was made up of students who were not in my grade or just people who probably thought it would be the best to, like, cut me out because it'll be easier, most likely, because, well, you can't cut out your friends easily or people who are kind of, I guess, important or, like, would be useful for winning constantly. That's what I'm saying.
Would you say, then, that, like, the fact that the people who are playing Survivor Rochester aren't complete total strangers, would you say that puts some people at a disadvantage?
Maybe. It's more of a case of prove yourself to be useful, and I think they'll keep you. Unless they hate you, then they'll probably kick you out, like, first thing first. I mean, that's the whole Survivor thing. Make alliances. If you're useful, they'll keep you. If you're too useful, they'll kick you out. If they like you, they'll keep you. If they don't like you, they'll kick you out. If you're just the easiest to kick out, they'll kick you out. That's all that.
Would you say that playing Survivor made you more interested in possibly watching the show, or did you still not have any interest afterward?
Nah. I mean, it's probably because I got voted out first, so, like, I wasn't able to, like, fully experience Survivor for all it is. So that's basically the most likely reason why I know I don't have any interest in, like, watching Survivor. And I didn't really have an interest in watching Survivor before, so I guess, yeah, no.
What advice would you give to someone who's interested in playing Survivor Rochester this summer?
Make an alliance beforehand. Make sure to be on the team of your alliance. Don't get voted out first like I did. And prove yourself to be useful in the first day.
Prove yourself to be useful. This summarizes the message at the core of Survivor. Find a way to gain the trust of others, create individual success, and then use it to beat your competitors. While competing in Survivor may form long-lasting bonds between players after the game has ended, it makes for an intense, almost hostile group of people with a drive to be the best. That's something viewers can strive for while watching the show. With Real College Podcast, this is Tosin Ficino.
And that's all for this episode of Real College Podcast. Real College Podcast is a production of Radio K. It's produced by Ben Hallam, Liv Riggins, Lizzie Ritchie, and Tosin Ficino. I'm Nathan Fervoy, your host and managing editor. All episodes of Real College Podcast can be found online at radiok.org or on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can follow us on Instagram for a look behind the scenes. Thanks for listening.